My name is Selene Kurka and I cordially welcome you to my podcast, Neue Musik Leben. I have studied classical music and singing, and nowadays and since many years I'm performing lots of contemporary experimental music and I do performance. And if you would like to know more about me, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. And I also welcome you to subscribe to my monthly newsletter. In this podcast, I talk around themes all around new contemporary music. And I share with you the behind the scenes, the insider knowledge, and what is most important to me. I want to bring the human beings out of this new music world closer to you. I thank you so much for all the feedbacks. I'm cooperating with the NMZ, the Neue Musik Zeitung. And I'm happy that I got to collaborate with Rainy Days Festival Luxembourg, with the Philharmonie, with the amazing artistic director Catherine Konz. And this is now the fourth interview in a little series I've done for them. And this fourth interview is with the mezzo-soprano Rosie Middleton. And Rosie Middleton performed a piece at Rainy Days that is called 12 Hours, and that is what it is about. It is a piece that lasts 12 hours. So let's get right into this really amazing talk with Rosie, and she really takes us in. She's very open about this whole process, what happened before, what happened during the performance, and also after and afterwards. And I think she touches so many important points. We also should consider performing pieces like this. So please enjoy the interview with Rosie Middleton.
Hello and good evening, Rosie Middleton. I welcome you to my podcast today, Neue Musik Leben.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I have been seeing you last week, but you might have not noticed me because you were busy performing a 12-hour piece and you maybe didn't know me, but now we get to meet each other and talk about this experience at Rainy Days. But first, I would like to know from you, how did you find your way into this new and experimental music?
Well, I know it's not new music, but when I was in my final year of opera training, I did Pierre Luna as part of a big concert. And I think I'd really found the opera training very conservative, and that it didn't use it really only focused on one thing, which was the classical voice used in one way. And when we did Pierre Luna, it opened up this kind of different world where both like musical kind of this sort of more cerebral element of music learning was welcome, but also using the voice experimentally, very experimentally for me at the time, but certainly even now it's not classical singing as we know it. So that felt very liberating. And after college I did do lots of new music, even at the beginning, but most of it was sort of very low paid or unpaid. And so it took a while to find my way. But in about 2018 I started commissioning work, and I created a project around voice loss and worked with some composers, one of which actually was Catherine Konz, which is where 12 Hours originated, and everything's kind of come from there really.
Yeah, oh, it's such a great piece. And yeah. So you were trained before like as a classical singer, and then the new music came to you?
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think it's for many of us the same. For me, it was the same too. But I also think, and it's for me at least, it was a very good base to have this classical training and then go from there and develop all those crazy techniques. How is that for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I still work with a classical singing teacher, although she specializes in new music as well, Hilary Summers. And that is very important for me. I don't think it is for all experimental singers, because they use their voices in different ways. But yeah, the training was good, but I'm very, very happy to have found my way into this weirder and, for me, much more interesting niche.
And I mean, now you have been for a little while or a few years in this music realm. And so how do you choose your repertory? What is fun for you to sing and perform?
Well, I've always been really interested in the physical and visual aspects of performance. So whether it's theatre or uses the body in a specific way, or there's a kind of potential abstract narrative around it, that is, that's interesting to me. But at the moment, what I'm really into is, I'm calling them process pieces, but I'm sure someone's already thought of a better name, where a composer sets up a process that kind of plays itself out in the body or the voice. So 12 Hours is a big example of that. But other composers that I've worked with that do this, Laura Bowler writes kind of this into the music as well, sometimes through repetition. I did her opera, The Blue Woman, and which was about post-traumatic stress disorder and sexual violence. And what I loved in that was that in the character's most stressful and darkest moment, then the music was created. It was one phrase repeated for 8 minutes on a rising, and it was rising higher and higher. And it created this kind of stress in the body and the voice that meant I didn't have to go anywhere too dark psychologically. It kind of created it for me. And so I think this is very exciting, and it's kind of it's a liberating thing to do, to hand over your, to trust a score in that way. But I've done quite a lot, like a lot of music like this, and that's kind of where I'm focusing my commissioning, I guess, at the moment. And yeah, that's when I do get to choose, that's what I'm choosing.
And what are the qualities you most appreciate in the composers you work with?
I think a I guess it's a generosity between us, where it feels like that there's a big spectrum of collaboration, right? So from the kind of singer as pure interpreter to kind of complete co-creator, and I'm really happy on all levels of that. But at every point, I think feeling like a conversation can be had around the music, or the composer's kind of responding and interested in what my voice and body does, then that feels really good. And especially doing the kind of work that I'm doing, which is often very intense, and either thematically very intense and difficult, or asks something specific like singing for 12 hours, then it really matters who's asking. And so working with someone like Catherine, who is so generous and warm, and she really set up a kind of playground rather than a with someone else that could have felt like a prison. It's a so yeah, I think it's that is very important.
And well, since now you have this classical training and you don't do crazy techniques with your voice, did you just learn it, learning by doing, or did you have teachers who helped you, or how's your approach with that?
Bit of both, partly just by taking a score, and when the score arrives, then you have to just work out how to do the thing in the score. And so sometimes that's something I do on my own. Someone that I actually learned a lot from was composer Essin Gündüz, who's a vocalist herself, and we created a piece together a few years back. And the creation process for that, we spent 2 weeks kind of improvising, and I'd improvise with prompts from her, and she created the electronic track from some of from all of these recordings. But the kind of improvising that I did with her opened up many different sounds in my voice and kind of the possibilities. So I'd say that was a really formative part of that. And yeah, and since it's just been, what's in this score and how do I do it?
I also find improvising a great way to open up and figure out and like, oh, I didn't know I could do that.
Yeah, it's so fun. And also other singers, other vocalists, like either listening to what they're doing or being lucky enough to sing with them, then suddenly you're, which I guess is sort of what happened with Essen, but like that then finds new places in the voice.
The other thing I'm also always curious about, because I noticed that singers are very different with that, is the thing with pitch. If you need to sing a certain pitch, if sometimes it doesn't matter, but sometimes it does matter. And I noticed that there are people who do a lot with the tuning fork. There's some people who have the perfect pitch. Well, lucky them. There are people who I work a lot with muscle memory. I don't have perfect pitch, but I'm also not a big fan of tuning fork. And so there are different approaches I realized. Or our colleague Juliet Fraser, she told me because she played the oboe for such a long time, she doesn't think she has perfect pitch, but because of this tuning, the A, she almost has perfect pitch. And so how do you deal with it if there's like precise pitches?
So I have
I have
almost perfect pitch,
almost.
which is very helpful. But I'd say it's
But
not
I'd say it's not
100%
100%
because
because.
there are people who can really sing you 440 for A every single time. And I would say I'm within an, I can sing you an A, but it might not be 440 or in your Germany, is it 443? I hit this when I was in France last month.
It depends on the context, and I mean, I know the accordions are often on 443. Sometimes it's also 442. Sometimes they go on 440, and I think it depends on the orchestra and context. And for me, it just, I mean, that's maybe then the advantage again of not having a perfect pitch. I don't really care so much if it's a little bit higher, a little lower. I mean, if I sing in like the old tuning, like 415. This is a big difference for me, but 440, 442, I just sing what I hear. I mean, if that's my surrounding, I just adapt to it.
Yeah, I probably do too because of this margin of error. And I played the violin as a child, so I think that probably is where I remember not being able to sing pitches and then making myself learn when I was about 11 because there was a girl in my class who could and I was very jealous. So I spent days or weeks kind of training it in. But yeah, it's not 100% accurate.
And yes, you did this 12-hour piece at Rainy Days Festival Philharmonie, Luxembourg, and I had the opportunity to see a little bit of it, but since I was also involved in so many other things while I was there, I think I saw like 40 minutes, but a friend of mine was there. I think she went in three times, and she also was there at the end. She told me a little bit. And well, at first I would like to know how did you kind of invent this piece? Why did you do a 12-hour piece?
Well, Catherine invented the 12 hours, but I'd originally asked Catherine to write me a piece exploring voice loss as a part of this voiceless series, and her like offer was to do something with endurance and see what happens to the voice over 12 hours. So that's where it came from. But we did kind of devise the narrative such as it was together. And yeah, but I would say the 12 hours is definitely Catherine's concept and piece.
You already did a 6-hour version before, right?
Yeah, we did 6 hours in London in September, and we'd also done three in June and four back in 2020. So I'd done a few trials.
Oh, good. That's really interesting. And I mean, I saw the stage. It was very colorful. It looked like a room or something very playful, I thought. And lots of options where I thought, like, okay, it doesn't have to get boring for you hanging out there for 4 hours or so. And I mean, you ate, and you wrote those letters, and there were dresses, and I mean, it really looked very beautiful. So you already told me you developed it together. So how did it feel now to do this piece?
Even a week on, it feels quite hard to answer that question. I think what happened in the 12 hours is that it induced every feeling of being a performer that I've had in the past, which is maybe kind part of the point as well. So for the structure of the piece is built around the performer's day. And every hour I cycle around the room visiting stations, there's a place to eat, like you said. There's a costume, there's a makeup table, there's a stage on which to perform, there's a practice area, and there's a cycle around this space every single hour. And each hour has its own theme. And it was about kind of what we wanted to do was pull back the curtain on the sort of perfectionism in the classical music industry and show our workings a bit more and see what happened. So the experience of doing it was very intense. And there were definitely moments of big elation, but there were some very lonely moments as well, particularly in the quieter hours, because there was a big symphony concert happened. And so really the things that have stood out so far in the reflections and how I've tried to think about it, are moments both of connection and loneliness. So I had some really beautiful moments with audience members. I had a very close friend in there, and there was a point, in fact, friend and collaborator, Sarah Parkin, and she was there for most of the performance. And there was a point when I got very, when it felt very difficult, and I felt quite emotional. I went and sat with her, and that was really lovely. And our bodies are very used to moving together because we create a lot of work together, and so that felt very natural. And then there was another point later on where these two amazing women turned up like fairy godmothers. It was around hour 9 that felt quite difficult, I think, or 10, and I was feeling quite tired, and suddenly these two women arrived, and one of them started playing with the costumes, and we played together for a while, and the other sat with me at the dressing table, and we improvised together for a while, which was really great and playful and fun, and it kind of drove it forward again, having had a bit of a dip in energy. And that, yeah, there was another point when I was playing whistling games with members of the audience, and all of that felt really, really wonderful. I think the sort of slightly darker moments, which perhaps were inevitable with a sort of long form performance like that, that the energy kind of comes and goes, felt quite lonely and hard to go on. But I'm really, really glad I did it. And it was there were yeah, I think it went to some quite strange places, which I would have expected, especially after the 6 hours, which was quite, I did some quite bizarre things. But yeah, as yet, it's such a fragmented memory that I have of the day. And it will only be when I start looking back at the photos or maybe seeing some of the film footage that I can kind of remember a bit more, I think.
Oh, that's interesting that you somehow you were so in it that you cannot even remember that much. I mean, it's also a long time span, and it's also nice to hear that the audience got involved and that it's both. And yeah, I didn't think about it. Yes, there were those other concerts where people were then in the big hall, or I was doing the guitars
I wish I
upstairs at
could.
some
So much I
point.
wanted to see, and couldn't because I was too.
And obviously, then maybe people went to a different place also. And yeah, that's really interesting. And looking back, do you have a feeling how much you were on stage, or how much did you go in and out, or did you enter right at 11, or did you enter later, or?
No, I was in at 11. I was in there 11 till 11. I did go to the loo a few times. And there was just one point where I took maybe, I think it was actually probably only about 3 minutes outside the room to kind of try and reset a bit because it was feeling, but pretty much, other than going to the bathroom, then I was in there the whole time.
Wow, because when I interviewed Catherine, we also did an interview for Rainy Days. We talked about the option that either you could be there 12 hours straight, or you could not show up at all. And she said that also could be an option. She was like, I don't think she will do that, but it's in the score.
Yeah, so I mean that's what makes it all feel possible, I think, in Catherine's when we first started this piece, I'd sort of said yes because I thought it sounded exciting, but then hadn't really thought it through, and I felt quite worried about it back in 2020. And I remember we did 4 days of development back then and a 4 hour performance. And in the days running up to the performance, I felt quite panicked. And I kept saying to Catherine, "Oh, what if I need to leave?" And Catherine just kept saying, "That's totally fine. Do what you need to do." And it was this really like lovely freedom in it. It's not, I'm not trapped in this space. I am free to choose to be there. And I think that then means I can choose to be there because and I wanted to choose to be there. It was a big choice. And I think there was a lot in my early career, singing classical opera, where consent perhaps was less of a, in fact, not on the table at all back in, 2014, 15, and it could feel very difficult at times, and like there was very little agency as a performer. And so this piece, although it sounds more extreme, I think in terms of the way that we prepared it, both from Catherine's perspective of her score and the freedom that she gave me within that, but also we took a lot of care around making sure that I did hydrate and that there were I worked with a vocal health team and all of this, and it was, I think, much less risky and much more kind of prepared with much more care than a lot of my early work, I think. So yeah, that was what made it possible.
And when you did leave the stage and went to the loo, how did that feel? How did going out and coming in feel for you?
Extremely functional. I went out and came back as quickly as I could. I didn't really want to be out of the space. Yeah, but it also, well, I guess we're talking about going to the bathroom now, but it wasn't an exercise in that wasn't the endurance was kind of the duration, and I know lots of performance artists do starve themselves in advance, or fast, I guess, in advance of performance, so that they don't have to leave the space. And we could do that option also as well, but as a singer, it felt really important to kind of take care of the voice, not just for that day, but in the sort of longer term afterwards. I've taken some, I have a couple of weeks off, but I do need to be able to sing again fairly soon. So it was kind of, yeah, that was a big part of it. So it really was kind of, like I said, yeah, quick and functional. And I managed, it didn't change very much once I came back into the room. The lighting and the atmosphere was quite intense, so that it was very easy to snap back in.
I mean, the part I have seen, I mean, there is your voice was also in the electronics, which sounded very beautiful. And what I have seen that I've seen you eat actually some Asian food or something looked yummy.
Okay, so you
And
were there around 3 o'clock, maybe 2 o'clock, I'm not sure.
yeah, maybe. Or was it early or earlier? I think it was a little earlier.
Okay.
I have interviewed RDD and I think then I came. Anyway, and I heard you also do things with your voice, but I remember more that you were doing things with your body, and I found also that interesting. I mean, it's your whole appearance, and that you did lots of physical things as well, how you were moving, or I think then you went to the floor, and then you, I don't know. Were on your knees on the, I think there was a little carpet. And so there were great options. So how was it then for your body if you, I mean, obviously you included physical things, which I think is a very obvious option. But you still have to do it for 12
Yeah, we I mean, the next day everything hurt. It was very I was very achy. I had done some physical preparation. I worked with a not I'm not generally sporty, but I do use my body a lot on stage. And so for this I did a bit more strength training, and swam quite a lot, which helped at least with and some yoga for balance and stuff. But I'm not a movement artist by training or anything, so it's just using the body and letting it do what it wants to do, which I think, like, again, went to some very strange places. I remember towards the end lying over a beanbag with my head essentially on the floor or head back and doing these strange circular crunches for quite a long time. Yeah, I don't know. But for me, the body stuff is liberating as well. It's the kind of the opposite of the stand and sing with a score, and it feels very it feels like very instinctive and playful, and yeah, I guess the some of it did was quite grueling on the body, but it didn't feel like that in the moment because I guess my performer brain was switched on and in a kind of buzzier place. So yeah, it was. Yeah, I'll be interested to see some of the footage back because I think I can only, like I said, my memory is so fragmented that I think I did a lot of stuff that I don't remember yet.
Yeah, that's always an important point. How much to sometimes we observe ourselves, and sometimes we're just in the moment, or we don't care, and sometimes it's parallel. And there was also a friend of mine who was in your piece. I think he was in there 3 or 4 hours, really
Wow.
long.
I tell him thank you. I really
And
appreciated the long time waits for those
he
notes.
really said it totally draw him in. And he also, I think, left because other friends of his were playing in the guitar piece, and then I think he went up, and that's when I saw him. But he was like, oh my God, this is so cool. And I remember myself, and I was then wondering, and also when I talked to Catherine about the options you have, because I have been doing, I think it was in 2013 or 14, 4 hour piece by Antoine Boyger at Huddersfield Festival.
Wow. Okay.
And it was a piece where I was just sitting on stage 4 hours, not singing 4 hours, but maybe half of it. And there were musicians with me, and I didn't mind being on stage. And then I also realized that even in regular opera, even if you do something like Susanna, that's a part for me, I'm not a Wagner singer. But in a classical opera, you're never that long on a stage. I mean, the longest might be maybe, I don't know, 50 minutes. I think some Wagner stuff is that long.
Okay.
And I'm like, 4 hours? And the thing, what I was most concerned was actually then also the bathroom. Everything else, I'm like, whatever. And there was a bathroom behind the stage. And Antoine also said, well, if you really have to, you go out, you come back in, and everything is cool. But I think you won't have to. And it was really funny because I think after like 2 hours, it was with stopwatch, so I knew exactly where we were. And I think after 2 hours, I really had the feeling I should go, and then I didn't, and I completely forgot about it. And suddenly those 4 hours were over. Like,
Yeah,
cool.
I mean the
And I
body,
mean we
yeah.
and we also, I think that's something you can tell me about how you prepared, because when we rehearsed it, I mean, this piece was kind of structured in 30 minutes, 30 minutes, 8 times 30 minutes. And so I think we did like the first two, and then Antoine commented on what he wanted, and then we did another one, and then he let go. I never did the 4 hour version before, just in the performance. And I felt it was very transformative. I'm so happy that I got to do this thing. And it's hard to describe what really happens, even though this piece is probably as a piece very different than what you did, and it's just 4 hours and not 12. But maybe you can let us know about the preparation, or how this, yeah, if there's anything more you want to tell us about this experience.
Well, just to say 4 hours is still a very long time, and I think that and it's long enough for the brain to go to this different space, I think. When I did the 4 hours in 2020, I also didn't go to the bathroom in that was at all. I stayed in the whole time. And it felt like I wanted to be in. I didn't want to leave at all. It was this, and I imagine you maybe felt something similar. It feels very special. And the same with 6 hours. I think I went out once, and I also in the 6 hour performance, something that I realized was that I was tactically dehydrating and I didn't eat. And it wasn't fully conscious. It was this performer brain thing that had set in. And I realized I didn't want to have to leave the room at all. And so I was being very, very like, I think I ate a banana and an oat cake over the 6 hours. And I was as physical as you saw, like a lot of it was very, very physical. And there was a point when I got quite lightheaded. And so when we were preparing for this, because it's double the length, like that's okay for 6 hours, but maybe not for 12 hours. And Sophia, particularly our dramaturg and movement director, she was very strict with me and came up with a system to mark. I was tying ribbons on this kind of crinoline cage skirt to mark the kind of, I was drink the minimum of water that I had to drink every hour, because if we didn't have this, I wouldn't have done it, I think. It was a way of tracking, so it didn't become an exercise in hurting myself, I guess, which I think it sometimes to performers doing extreme work can, especially classically trained performers, we have this kind of pride in exhaustion and pride in our ability to withstand pain and all of these things. And I think that what we didn't want 12 hours to be about that. But so even though I had all the choice that Catherine gave me in the London 6 hour performance, I didn't choose very many health, I didn't make very many healthier choices, and it was fine. And I really enjoyed it. Whereas this time we kind of tried to make that because it was so long. But it was different, and the kind of performative, transformative space thing, I went through lots of cycles in the day, whereas in the 6 hour performance and the 4 hour one, it kind of was one mega cycle. Preparation, sorry, you asked about preparation. What we did was we spent a lot of time working through through a set of suggestions for each hour. So each hour had a couple of emotional states suggested. So for example, hour one is curiosity, joy, and courage, I think. And hour six or seven is fear, anxiety, and loneliness. And these are kind of suggestions. And Catherine and I and Sophia worked together to kind of find a sort of energy level for each hour for me to kind of start with at least. And types of movement. So some hours that were much more fluid, and some were very kind of anxious and repetitive and potentially compulsively doing lots of different things, which kind of also feeds into the performer preparation of what we all do to take care of ourselves pre-performance. And so I had them in a book, and I'd read the book before each hour. Obviously can't rehearse. It's impossible to rehearse this piece because it's the duration that is the piece. And so unless you do the duration, you're not rehearsing it. But we did spend times in with the electronic track on for each hour, kind of just playing a bit with some movement, talking about possible vocalizations, although it was all improvised in the moment. And really looking at where there might need input. So actually, one thing I haven't spoken about yet is the post box, which was the audience could write letters to me, but also so could Catherine and Sophia. And Sophia, and in fact Kate, our vocal health, Kate Valentine, our vocal health person, my brain's not working, a vocal health advisor. She was there as well, and they wrote me some notes with suggestions and scores, but the audience wrote these lovely letters as well, and some people wrote me scores in mid performance, and that was all very helpful as well to kind of feed in, if I was sort of running out of stuff. So yeah, it was sort of working through and seeing what needed to be there, what food would be possible to even eat. It feels very vulnerable eating in front of people in that way, and being in front of people for so long feels very vulnerable as well. So it's sort of finding the things to support that.
Wow. And you already said you were exhausted on the day after, and it's still working through your body, through your mind. And yeah, I'm curious what else you will figure out of it. And I don't know if you know to go to 24 hours.
Ask me about that in the new year. I think I need a bit of recovery time first. Who knows?
Yeah, it's since we do things like this, I mean, not 12 hours, but quite a while, I always often think of when Abramovich did the thing at the Museum of Modern Art, which she was sitting on this table and looking, and she also didn't go to the bathroom, I think, for 8 hours, and she was just sitting there, and she said she didn't want to move, so sometimes her back or her hands or something hurt. And they built her a little thing under the chair. She could have also gone there to the bathroom, but
Oh
she
God.
never did. Well, yeah, interesting stuff we do.
Yeah, and it is interesting thinking about going to the bathroom and that she had that option, because I think it would be a very different thing for a man to do the piece that I just did. The way that we see female bodies and female kind of physicality, the judgment around it is very different. I spoke to a male performer and performance artist, and he said he'd just go in the room. But if I did that, that would be the only thing the piece was about, and it would be this kind of, it would be the focus of. But I can see how a man, I guess they're more discreet in there. So yeah, maybe it would be more possible.
Interesting. I don't know if there are pieces like that with men.
Well,
No pieces. They can tell
yeah.
us. And well, I also would like to know a little bit more about you, even though we already progressed quite a while in this nice talk. I mean, you're singing so much and developing pieces, and how do you manage your day? Are you more a structured person, a flowy person, or how do you get everything done?
Flowy and chaotic. I think I saw your question asking for advice, and I'm not the person to give advice on structuring days. But it's yeah. I think the difficulty with finding a structure is that each week is quite different. But yeah, I'll try and do, if I'm at home working, then try and do, a couple of hours of admin, and then force myself to stop and do some practice so I'm not just sat at a computer. But more often than not, it's harder to plan than that because there might be a rehearsal somewhere or a meeting, and yeah, very unstructured.
And are there things you do that kind of balance you, or I don't know, like you mentioned yoga, or are you liking walking through the forest or whatever, cooking?
Well, I live in London, so we are short on forests here, but yeah, yoga really helps. Cooking and listening to Desert Island Discs helps a lot. And the other thing that I've worked with an acupuncturist quite a lot, particularly in the run up to this and recovery. And for me, that's very helpful.
Awesome. Awesome. Wow. Yeah. I often think about that. When I sometimes think about like sports people, like very professional sports people, and how they really I mean, there are many parallels to musicians, but they always plan time for to get what's the word? Regeneration, yeah, that's the word. And they really plan it. And I have the feeling with musicians, with me or people who I know, we're always going, going, going. And I have one colleague, he says he tries to take one day off with his voice. And I've done that years ago, but now I don't do it at all. I always practice. And but then I think of those sports people and how, whatever, if you're in a big, famous, whatever, soccer team, you have your person who massages you and all that, and I would like that too. And I think I heard that Anne-Sophie Mutter, the famous violin player, she also goes often to a massage after a concert, and I think this is smart.
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't budget for it in most projects, and it can be, I mean, I used to work crazy hours all of the time and feel like I had to be constantly productive and to be for it to be worthwhile or for it to be good enough. And actually, the last few years I've managed to reset that a bit. And 12 hours I have planned recovery time into it because I didn't know if I'd lose my voice for a bit. Like I wasn't sure. I haven't. It's fine, but it's tired. So I have actually planned time off now. And working with the vocal massage was yeah, it's been amazing. But I had funding for that. I don't normally necessarily have funding for that. And yeah, I think this year and the projects I've done over the last few years have been extremely intense. And I worked with a performance psychologist at one point, which was very helpful. But it's sort of finding the money for that can be difficult. And yeah, I do think structuring care around, when we're planning budgets for projects, if at all possible, we need to be including money for that. So if the project is about, well, sexual violence, for example, which I've done quite a few that are, there needs to be someone taking care of psychological support on the team, if at all possible, because as singers, more than instrumentalists, we go to very dark places sometimes in the stories we're telling. And particularly in new music, people seem to be telling a lot of very, I guess, very current stories. So yeah, I think I would love to see more producers, which is happening more in the UK, actually, despite the arts cuts, kind of putting this kind of stuff into the budget so that we can be taken care of and more like athletes, I guess.
It's great that we talk about it. I've never seen it here, or but I'm not sure. But I think it's great that we have it in this podcast and that we should consider it, or like you say, if it's possible to put it in there. I mean, I have also one or two people where I go to whatever they do things with my body. And I
Mm.
mean, I go there like once a month, and particularly when I have been traveling a lot,
Yeah.
because I also think just, carrying around luggage, this
Yeah.
is not healthy for me. And I'm sure I might go a little awkward or somehow, to catch the train or something, and then run with this heavy stuff. And then I always go there because I'm like, I don't want to have a problem.
Yeah.
I'd rather go there first that
Yeah.
I'm fine with it and I can handle all that. But that's also something I'm like, could there be another systems? I dream that we would have like a luggage cloud where we just put in our stuff, and wherever I am on this world, I can just pull it out. Why is nobody inventing this?
Well, maybe someone will now. That's a great idea, and I would love this too. Yeah, I mean, I think this is so important, and I think so long in classical music, more so in, I guess, traditional classical music, but in all of it, we pretend that we're not humans with bodies and brains that have had experiences, and we kind of present this stoical perfectionism to the world, and actually. It feels crazy if you think about it. If you think about a classical opera singer, she's if she's singing solo roles in traditional opera, she's very likely to have been like murdered, abused in multiple ways, and experienced a lot of violence on stage. And given the statistics that we know about violence against women, I think in the UK it's 1 in 4 women have experienced sexual violence, for example. Like, it's very likely these stories have resonance with their real lives. So if we're not taking care of the storylines, and this is beginning to happen here at least, which I'm really happy about, then essentially we're gonna, well, we do end up with singers having a very difficult time in the jobs, and they're kind of just expected to get on with it. And yes, it's a story, and we're telling stories, and it's all theatre, but these are still our bodies and our minds that are experiencing these things on stage. And I think we can do better than has been done so far, even, yeah, across the board. So, but yeah, I think what we're all doing privately to kind of take care of ourselves and our physical bodies is an important part of it. But I think companies and directors and producers that are asking people to put their bodies and minds through extreme situations do need to consider what support is needed for the singer or whoever to do their best possible job. Yeah, that.
Yeah, it's really great to think about it, because I know most of them, or yeah, they're like, okay, I want to do it, I just do it somehow, and you don't think
Yeah.
about consequences. And I also wonder now, when I think of whatever really big Hollywood film productions, I mean, they also, I think, have a big support system when they do funky roles, or they whatever talk to, I don't know, some serial murders for a few weeks or something, when they whatever portray it. And probably it's they're much more included than in our world. And you're right. I mean, sometimes we really portray very dark places. And yeah. And who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you, and what inspires you?
Such a big question. I feel like I've been shaped by so many people and places, but I guess to focus it in a bit on sort of as a musician doing new music. But the composers that I've worked with intimately have shaped a lot. And then in the UK, we do have very few opportunities to develop new work, and it is quite a tough place to do it. But places like Tête-à-Tête Opera Festival, they've been extremely supportive and allowed me to kind of try stuff out there and create new things, and that's been a big part of shaping it. And the other one is sort of finding a way through when I was sort of trying to work out how to do this and how to do new music. I started looking at vocalists in the UK who were doing it already, and so looking at Juliet Fraser and Elaine Michener and Laurie Lixenberg in particular, who are all extremely different artists, but doing kind of really exciting creative things with their voices and their identities as well. Like, I think they have so looking at their careers and artwork shaped a lot of how I kind of approached my own, in that it gave me a way forward. I kind of fell out of love with the opera world, or the classical opera world, the traditional opera world, some years back. And I did consider other careers and sort of was thinking about where else to go. And I realized I couldn't give up music. It was too awful a prospect. And so by looking at artists like Juliet and Elaine and Laurie, and seeing these like multiple different ways to make a career and to perform and make art, like that was extremely inspiring. And I think that probably was the biggest thing, like seeing these people doing stuff that I found exciting and yeah, and that was liberating from and was liberated from the traditional classical world. I know it's all linked and it's kind of an evolution of, but for me it feels very distinct working in new music.
Yeah, I find it also quite freeing. Even, but I also realize, I mean, I also sometimes get hired for classical stuff, and I think I also feel much freer there because I don't care so much whatever interpretations there are, and I really like that.
That's
And
brilliant. It's
I think also because of what we do with our voices and what we discover, we have more colors. And there's also a very wonderful baritone. He's very famous, Bo Skaarup. He's Danish. And he also does not like contemporary, but he does Voitsig a lot by Berg. That's one of his signature roles, which he does amazing. But I also have seen him years ago. He was jumping in for Don Giovanni in Cologne. He was the Don Giovanni. And I was so thrilled because, especially with the recitativi, they were so colorful and so emotional. And he used whatever breathy voice or all things we do, but oftentimes, like classical opera singers don't do that. They just sing beautifully. But he was just very, oh, it was amazing. And that's something I also often dream of, that they would allow us to do more of those classical roles, because I think we could add so much to it.
Yeah, I bet. I'd love to see you do that. And also, it was it Bo you said his name.
Bosco was, yeah.
Yeah, Bo Skaarup. Yeah, I think that'd be very exciting. For me, I think I'm okay with not singing classical repertoire in that way. I think I've sort of chosen to kind of look really just to new music. But yeah, I really there are some people also here that are kind of straddling both worlds, and it's very exciting to see them in who are the slightly sort of weirder and wonderful new music singers also in that world. Yeah, it's always very inspiring.
Yes, I kind of, I still like both, even though I'm also whatever 9% of my time contemporary music. And I think it's, yeah, because I do it well, but also I don't know if it's the same in the UK, but it seems like I have this label on my head. And so oftentimes the people who would have cast something more, whatever, Handel, Mozart, they don't think of me. They're like, she's the one for the new music. So.
I mean, yeah, I think that happens as well. I think in the UK, except in my case, I don't have the 9% of I yeah, stopped saying yes to old music a while ago. I still love listening to it and going to see it. There's some music, especially because that's, you know, as a violinist, as a child, like Baroque music as well is really in my, it feels like every fiber of my being has been shaped by being a violinist as a child. And I love hearing other singers sing that stuff, but I don't want to sing it anymore. I think I'm very happy in this strange world.
Yeah, it's cool. Like you said, I observed that too with all our whatever singing colleagues or singing women colleagues or soprano colleagues or however. And we are all so different. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's nice.
And how do you keep true to yourself in this music business? Is it easy? Authenticity?
What a word. That's easier as I've got older. And I would say I've only managed, I would only feel that I was doing that most of the time over the last couple of years. And since really kind of establishing new music as the entirety of my career, I felt more able to. finding being able to choose projects is great, and that's and choose composers to work with, but that's not always the case. And choosing the team that like so 12 Hours was amazing because we chose our team and everybody on it was very like generous and well and warm, and it felt like a very collaborative space. But when I work in when I'm hired for other jobs, it's okay. It can be more challenging if it's a big institution, and it's kind of working out how to, I suppose, take care of myself in the workplace. So even if it is a slightly compromising, or it feels a bit more compromising as a situation, it's being able to kind of, the word boundaries is really overused, but being able to know what they are and work with them means that I can work in those spaces and remain authentic, I guess, or like or feel like I'm working with agency, even in those spaces. But yeah, I mean, I love creating new work. I love being in the research and development phases. I think that's when it feels like a playground again, and anything could happen. And for me, that devising period is as fun or as interesting as the kind of performance. But I'm still learning.
And what does success mean for you?
Oh, I suppose if I think back to where I was 5 years ago, then doing what I'm doing now is a success for that. But of course, now the parameters have changed. So now there's more challenges I want to, to face, and more work I want to do, and it's kind of expanded outwards. And I think lots of us as performers kind of get so focused on what's next that it can be difficult to enjoy the moment as well. And these kind of, and so I think I'm trying to really like feel right now in this period after 12 hours, like I've just done something that I really wanted to do, at a festival that like was filled with so many amazing artists, and that for me is a bit of a dream, like that in that space, and to be able to do 12 hours in all of the ways, the creation of it, the practice of it, of and the endurance and everything about it was kind of so yeah, success. I don't I'm not going to bore you with my my 5-year plan, but the yeah I'm trying to enjoy the aftermath of that, and yeah, but I have lots of as yet unfulfilled ambitions also.
I don't have a 5-year plan.
I don't either, to be honest, but I feel like I should have a 5-year plan. It's I have things I want to do.
Okay. I mean, I always write things down when I get an inspiration, and sometimes they work out at some point. This is cool. Is there anything that drives you forward, or do you have a vision?
I think the creation of new work that feels like I'm telling a story, and whether it's abstract or has a very direct meaning, feels important to me personally. Like it feels like a, it can be very difficult to express ourselves in day-to-day life, I think sometimes, and so perhaps the intensity of projects to which I'm drawn allows that expression, and me to tell stories that, I mean, the audience don't necessarily know what stories I'm telling, but I'm telling stories that there is some communication and some meaning will be taken, and people take what they need or want or project things onto it, and that I really appreciate as well. So yeah, I think storytelling and being able to use my voice and body in that way feels good. And I guess that drives it forward. I love music. I really do, and I love theatre in the broadest sense. And if I go and see something, I want to feel something, whether it's something good or bad. Like I want it to, like the things that have that kind of put a visceral that makes something feel visceral inside, or that's the stuff I want to see, and that's the stuff I like I'm also interested in making, not exclusively, but that's, yeah, I think where it is.
Yeah, so great talking to you. I hope to see you somewhere place again. And we're actually at our last question.
Okay.
And I would like to know which tip would you like to give young or younger artists?
Well, apart from the very practical of in the UK, they definitely will need a side hustle that doesn't take up too much of their time. So something that they can do to support themselves while they're establishing their performing career. That aside, I think it's really working out what is important as for them. So in the first years, I think most people take any job that comes, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's good to kind of spend some time figuring out who you are as a person and performer, because I think lots of people leave music college still not sure who they are, and perhaps not, you know, we've spent so long in this training world of like shooting towards something, and I think maybe it's sort of the late 20s, 30s when you can figure that out a bit more. So yeah, do those things, but don't, I think, do you know, actually, the one thing that I would really love to be taught to all young singers, and probably all young people actually, but all people, is learn being able to say no nicely. So if someone asks something that feels compromising or tells you to do something, it's finding a way to kind of divert that and make another suggestion. If it doesn't feel okay to say no, I'm not going to do that, to kind of offer something else as an alternative, so that they're not compromising themselves time and time again, because we can do this for a while, but I think it wears you down after a while. So I think that's what, when I've done workshops with younger singers, that's been the kind of, one of the slides has been like, how do we, like, let's find ways to kind of offer alternatives if we're not feeling comfortable with a situation, or find ways out, and not feel like you just have to say yes to everything, which is, I think, really feels like that is the case, you know, especially in the UK, where there is a scarcity of work, and you know, you feel like you have to be the most willing, the most extreme, the most et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it taking learning to take care of ourselves.
That's very, very important. Thank you so much for this advice, and still learning it too.
Oh, me too. Gets easier, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And well, thank you so much that you took your time this evening to talk to me about your experience with 12 hours at Rainy Days Festival Flamini Luxembourg. And yeah, hope to see you around.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
This was the interview from today. I hope that it inspired you. And please send me your emails, send me your feedback, because I love to interact with you. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really, really hope that you liked it. And please tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. I thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.